Please be turning to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, 1 through 14 is going to be our text for the evening. Paul told us that we needed to be clothed with humility. And I want to get out of Luke chapter 14 a message on humility, especially as it pertains to these seats that these people were jockeying over. But before we do that, I need to get a little context from chapter 14, verses 1 through 6. Sabbath day hospitality was really important to the Jews. It wasn't unusual then for Jesus, as a great teacher, to be invited over to someone's house for a meal after the synagogue service, and we find that to be the case in this instance. Sometimes those invites were made with the best of intentions. At other times, there were secret motives that were taking place there. They were underlying the invitations. Of course, Jesus, always fully aware of the intentions before he even accepted those invitations. It says in John chapter 2, 24 and 25 that Jesus did not need anybody to testify about man because he knew what was in man. We see that played out in very real sense when you'd see phrases throughout the Gospels like, and Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, and so we need to think about how intimidating that would have been to be in his presence. I think when Peter came to the realization of who Peter was, or who Jesus was, and what he was capable of, it led him to his knees to say something like, Lord, depart from me, for I am a sinful man. When you know that this powerful Son of God, who could cause all these great catch of fish to jump into the boat, and it just kind of hits you who it is standing before you, what an intimidating thing that would be. The lawyers and the Pharisees, however, must have thought themselves terribly clever for having concocted the perfect scenario or contrived this perfect trap. And yet it's Jesus who's going to demonstrate that he cannot be cornered. He will not be put in a box or put in a lose-lose situation. His wisdom was unparalleled, and he would be unrivaled among his foes every time. By the time this was all over, the very man, this man with dropsy, who was supposed to provide evidence against Jesus, he became the man that provided evidence against the Pharisees, evidence of their own hypocrisy. There are five different kinds of people, five different men. Some of them wear different hats, and they might be the same person in this context, but we're basically talking about the same context, the same event taking place in the whole chapter. We're not going to spend any time really with 15 through 24, but the first set of people are those who are hypocritically bound to tradition. And I want you to see these people in verses 1 through 6. It says, it happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath, that they watched him closely. And behold, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus, answering, spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? But they kept silent. And he took him and healed him and let him go. Then he answered them, saying, which of you, having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit, will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? And they could not answer him regarding these things. Now, dropsy was, from what I could find in my research, a very painful illness, a very painful disease that was brought on by kidney trouble or a heart ailment or liver disease, and it would cause the soft tissue to hold excess water, and something that was known today, I think, as edema. And I know that with lots of doctors in the auditorium, I'm not in a great position to explain much of this to some of you. But from what I could tell, or what I could see when I looked for pictures, which is always something that you are hesitant to do, not something that you would have thought would be somebody that would be invited to this occasion, to this wedding feast. or to this man's house, unless it was for a specific purpose. This man was there most likely as a plant, that he would be, it was an opportunistic sort of thing to see if Jesus would heal him. The question they likely, of course, debated was, how long do you think Mr. Compassionate can go before he violates the Sabbath day? And, of course, Jesus took the initiative by asking the very question that the Pharisees and lawyers were wondering and waiting for him to see if he would do. The silence in verse 4, they kept silence when Jesus took the initiative, asked the question about the legality of healing this man. The fact that they kept silent, to me, betrays the dishonesty. It betrays the hypocrisy. It just, you know, if these people are legitimately concerned about the law of God being kept and observed, then you would think that they would be very forthcoming in their understanding, their interpretation of the law. They're wanting this to happen. They will rejoice in this. Remember 1 Corinthians 13, love does not rejoice in evil. Of course, Jesus did not commit evil, but in their interpretation, their tradition would have said Jesus committed evil here, and yet they were waiting for this. They were hoping for it. That explains the silence on their part. And so Jesus here is going to expose the false piety of these Pharisees, because while they claimed to be defending God's Sabbath law, in reality they were denying God by the way they abused people and upheld their traditional interpretations of the law. Just like in Galatians 5:23, where he concludes the fruit of the Spirit with love, against such there is no law, these people had well made a law against love, against showing mercy, against doing good to the two people on the Sabbath, as if that's any was in the mind of God at all when he gave his Sabbath command. Jesus seems to have lived by the perspective that it was always right to do right, that it was always appropriate to do good. And so with that background, he says in verse 7, so, connected context here, so he told a parable to those who were invited when he noted how they chose the best places, saying to them, when you're invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him come to and say to you, give place to this man, and then you begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you're invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that when he who invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, go up higher, then you'll have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. And so Jesus observes the jockeying that is going on. It's taking place for the best seats, which most likely would have been the seats with greatest honor, would be closest to the host. Again, most likely that's what they were all trying to position themselves for. The scurrying about, you kind of see that taking place sometimes when you got a potluck going on, and you can tell the prayer is just about to be offered, and you've got the scurrying for the front of the line, wherever that place is going to be, right? That's a picture I get of these guys, that they're just kind of putting them, oh, this is where you're sitting. Oh, okay, well, I guess I'll just take this seat right here. It's human nature, right? Human nature to want the best seats for ourselves. It is contrary to our nature to think, well, I'm going to save this for somebody else. That starts when we're kids. You hear it arguing over the front seat, and they're racing to the car. First one there gets this and that. We try to teach that to our kids, that the last will be first will be last, and now they've kind of turned it against us. And so that when, you know, like Laura and I are in two cars, we're on our way home, and it's like, Slow down. They're, you know, we don't want to be first, because really the winner is the one that gets there last. And so they kind of twisted that, you know, one way or another, they're going to be first. But it's not just kids. You know, it's adults too. We want the best. We want the best seats at sporting events. We want the one behind home plate at center field. We want the skybox seat. They're the ones that offer the best view, command the highest prices, and carry the greatest bragging privileges. The parking lot is a similar case study. You got people almost running into each other to try to get the spot that's just a few places closer than the next spot. Even at a workout club, you got people like, "Where's the best spot? I don't want to walk any further than I have to." So what's up with that? Once on a flight, overheard a grown woman arguing with the flight attendant about not getting to have the window seat. I reserved the window seat. She really bent out of shape about that. When you have guests into your home, what chair do you invite them to sit in? If you know, growing up, like in my family, we had this chair that like the center rung was like broken on one side. It kind of sagged a little bit. "Ross, you sit there." It's always give that to your son, right? It's okay if it breaks on you, but you know, the guest got the one with the pad. The guest got invited to the recliner afterwards. You make sure that they get the best seat. Did you know that diplomatic negotiating teams spend hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars preparing and making sure that the seating arrangements are just right so that the visiting dignitaries are afforded the proper honor based on the placement in the room? A slip here can have serious consequences. And in Africa, go preaching in Africa, you'll notice that everybody's sitting on the ground. And some might be lucky enough to have found a log somewhere. But the visiting American preachers, there's like, you know, a couple of chairs. And they always save that for the visiting preachers. And if you're familiar at all with James 2, you know how uncomfortable that is to sit in that chair. You don't want that chair. You don't want the best seat. And you know, you try to say, "No, I want to be like them and sit with them, and sit where they sit." You find out that that's like a big insult. So you sit there anyway because it's going to be a long day and you're not used to that. That's a big deal. It's contrary to human nature. We want that for ourselves. We want to be comfortable. Don't you remember those disciples who had the same problem with Jesus when they wanted for themselves? James and John in Mark 10, 35 through 37, they wanted the best seats. They asked, Jesus said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant that we may sit in your glory, one on your right and one on your left." They wanted the best seats in the kingdom, the places of honor and prestige. Natural thing for a natural man. Even still, I'm intrigued in Luke 14 that after what he just experienced in 1 through 6, with the hypocrisy, with the lack of love for this guy, with the trying to trap the Lord, that's got to be a crime. Jesus takes them to task for this, they're jockeying for the best seat. Isn't that surprising to you that of all of those things going on, he would really get down to, "I don't like what I'm seeing here concerning the seat that you're trying to pick for yourself." It's as if there's something bigger going on here, isn't it? Don't you think there's something bigger going on than making sure that you choose the right seat for yourself? Obviously, it's more than seating arrangements. And I don't, of course, want you to go away from here thinking, "Well, I learned how to find my seat, find the right seat when I go to a wedding feast." This is bigger than that. This teaches me that Christianity is about more than what goes on, you know, on Sundays and Wednesdays. Christianity is going to affect my life. It's going to affect my day-to-day decisions. It's going to change my life, everything about my life, even perhaps where I choose to sit and whom I invite over to the house for dinner. Like verses 12 through 14 says, that he said to him who invited him, "When you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends or your brothers, your relatives, nor rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you. For you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just. Oh, but Jesus, we had that man with the dropsy. Didn't you see him? That doesn't count when he's a plant, okay? You get the sense that this man has invited the upper class. He's invited the wealthy. He's invited, the upper echelon of society, so that he can have a formal, fine feast. What about you and me? Do you ever, go through the directory and try to find people that you think probably aren't connected very well? And who is it that's just kind of detached? Who is it that probably doesn't get a lot of invites? Who is it that's likely not going to be having many, dinners in their home? Who is it that we could have the best time with? Who is it that would be the most fun to have over? That's really speaking quite personally, I think, to us. Christianity is going to change that sort of approach. And can you imagine that our decision on who our guest list would be would meet us at the resurrection? And you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you, for you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just. Again, this is more than seating arrangements. It's more than dinner guests. This is about how we feel about other people. That's how it's connected to 14:1-6. These people, you might think, this is not just about Sabbath traditionalism or hypocrisy. This is about, they really think they're better than this guy. They have no love for this guy. True humility is not just about how a man thinks. It is about having the mind of Christ in us, Philippians 2. But it's also about how a man walks. What does the Lord require? Micah 6, remember Micah 6, 8. What doth the Lord require? He says in that list of things, to walk humbly. It's about not just how you think about yourself, but about how you walk with your God. All right, so three things about the best seat. The best seat in the house really is the last seat, according to verse 10. New American Standard, when you're invited, go and sit down in the last place. Mine has the lowest place. The message, of course, here is verse 11. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Doesn't the Lord know how to do that? Haven't we seen that in Scripture? Can't Joseph give testimony to how the Lord can exalt a man from the lowest place to the highest place? Can't Nebuchadnezzar testify to how the Lord can humble a man and take him from a high place to a very low place, even to the pasture? The best seat in the house is the seat that no one else wants. No one else wanted there would have been lots of room in that dining room, and no arguing, no fighting, no having to push your way through down at the other end of the table. Those seats, the best seat in the house, according to Jesus, is the seat that no one else wants. And so we need to be willing to do the job that no one else wants. And we apply that principle. Be willing to work and do the things that nobody else wants to sign up for. When it comes to doing work, we love the first pick, right? We love first dibs on what I get to choose for myself. You ever thought about choosing the one that you know nobody else is going to want to do? That's just, again, not how we think. God sees that, and He says He will reward. I still remember working grocery retail. I'd love it when I could get out of the register and not be tied to the checkout line as much, and get out on the floor, kind of maybe work the shelves or help customers find stuff. Safeway was big on that. You don't get that as much anymore, but there's these guys that I'd work with that they'd always be wandering around. It's like, well, I can't find anything to do. And, you might think that they just weren't looking hard enough, but the real problem, I think, was that they weren't looking low enough. There were plenty of things to do. They weren't fun. You know, they weren't something you'd want to do. And there's one manager that really stands out to me. His name is Rick Edmonds. And, you know, just the fact that I'm talking about him, 15 years later, is just remarkable. It's a tribute to his character. He was a store manager. And yet, when somebody went into the bathroom and really made a mess of the place, and I think vandalizing the place, and you just kind of did not want to go anywhere near there. That's where our store manager was. He didn't get some high school bagger to get some rubber gloves and go handle that. He was in there. He was cleaning that up. And that just really, really stuck with me. And if I may embarrass Daniel Martin, because I knew when I wanted to cover this text, I'd be talking about what I saw Daniel Martin do for Brother Iverson when he was in the hospital and he'd finally wake up and have all that phlegm in his throat. If you visited him, you know how he got congested. There's Daniel over there running to get a towel so that he can let him clear his throat. And he with his bare hands there, taking that over to him, wiping him. It's like, is this your father or something? So, no, I don't think they're related. But that's what I'm talking about here. This is the seat that no one else wants. I once heard it said that the branch that bears the most fruit bends the lowest. And that's what I saw. And I know there's a lot of accounts I could give from this congregation of people that do that sort of thing. Some of you, I'm not great with sports trivia, but some of you will have heard of John Brody. Former quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers was once asked why a $1 million player like him should have to hold the ball for field goals and extra points after the touchdown. Well, said Brody, if I didn't, it would fall over. He wouldn't take the bait. He wouldn't exalt himself. I mean, it would have been an opportunity for him to talk about how important he was to the game and how, you know, there could be an accident. He could kick my hand. Do you know how much this hand is worth? You know how much I make? That sort of thing. But no, I got to hold it up because it would fall over otherwise. Finally, the best seat in the house is the one in which Jesus sat. Jesus chose the lowest. Jesus is not, he did not come as someone who, because of his position, insisted that he be treated in accord with the honor that was due him. He, according to John 13 and many other passages, showed us humility in that he rose up to kneel before the disciples. When every one of them sat in that room after having arrived from their journeys to come together and eat the feast together, I guess waiting to see who it would be that would perform this common task of washing feet in preparation for the supper, he rose up to kneel and wash each of his disciples' feet. It is the seat that Jesus chose for himself. It doesn't sound like much of a winning formula, does it? To choose the lowest, to choose the worst, to leave it for somebody else. You probably wouldn't find it listed in the top 10 most important habits of successful people. Your employer, the boss, is probably not going to have something on the wall that says, you know, strive for the lowest, that's not what corporate America is about. It's about trying to fight for yourself and to obtain and acquire more. It's about looking out for yourself, looking out for you and yours. But it's God's plan for success. There are some great seats available. We've already talked about the lowest seat, the last one, the one nobody wants, all that. There's some great seats of honor available, though. It's just now's not the time to be trying to take them for ourselves. God will provide them for us. Note that, in Mark chapter 10, verse 40, when Jesus was asked about these great seats, couldn't we sit by your right, on your right and left? Jesus does not say, well, those don't exist, or I don't even know what you're talking about. He said, to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared. My mind is blown by that. It's just beyond my comprehension. But he does not deny that these seats exist. Maybe humanity is not even in the running. I don't know if that's the case. What I do know, according to Luke chapter 12 and verse 37, that when we get there and we are prepared to sit down and dine with him, he says, blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, finds watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them. So we can look forward to that even in the next life. The Lord is true to his character. He does not look forward to having a bunch of little minions finally arriving to heaven so that they can relieve the angels and further serve God, the Lord Christ. But no, he's going to gird himself and serve us. We will be elevated. And these great seats that are not his to give, just, I don't know, if that's available, I'd like that. But what's the path? What's the path to that? It's not by convincing everyone around us that we're the most spiritual. It's not by trying to gain the approval and the praise of other people. It's by doing like what Daniel did, which he would have done whether I was there or not. I'm quite certain of it. Choosing the last, choosing the lowest, the one no one else wants, the one that Jesus wanted. He who will be first will be last, and the last will be first. Well, Colossians 3:12, the holy and elect of God, clothe yourselves with humility. We put it on. That's what he called us to do. He's also called us to clothe ourselves with Christ, and he taught us how to do that in Galatians 3:27. We become children of Abraham, he said, when we, through our faith, are baptized into Christ. We clothe ourselves with Christ. And becoming one with Christ and entering into Christ, we're then prepared to humble ourselves and be conformed to his image. And we want to offer an invitation at this time to anybody who's not yet done that. If you are ready to commit your life to God and Christ and confess your faith that he's the Son of God this evening, we stand ready, prepared, very willing, ready, and hopeful that you would avail yourself of this opportunity. Please come forward now while we stand and sing.